Blog Talk Radio.
I'm delighted to be back in the United States, my hunting ground of 35 years. The country where I had my innings in the social and economic struggle, and where I decided to devote myself to the presentation of anarchism, a social philosophy which aims at the emancipation, economic, social, political, and spiritual, of the human race.
Without any further ado, I'd like to introduce tonight's keynote speaker, MIT linguistics professor, Mr. Noam Chomsky.
You know what? All you fucking George Mason University graduates, fucking valedictorians, fucking boyfriends in the army, fucking bitter expats. You're right. Noam Chomsky, I think I'm Noam Chomsky. Dropped out of college, but I think I'm Noam Chomsky. My style is Al Jazeera, your cats are CNN to me. Howard Zinn is dead, I must be Noam Chomsky. You're rapping about money and ex-girlfriends and who you're serving. The ocean's rising when the world ends, who you're serving. Who you run with and what you're running from.
History.
We're going into wars, dying in the desert for empire. Go on, tell me this is worthless. Like Bob Dylan couldn't stop killing in Vietnam. But in Afghanistan, Iran helped us overthrow the Taliban. So while we pointing missiles at the Ayatollah, Bikini Atoll used to be an island. They blew up with nukes. Next day in France, they unveiled a bikini swimsuit. Half naked empire, the emperor is half black. So in hip hop, I can only half criticize. Big surprise, Pentagon announced we might not leave after all. The theater of war, Iraq, the desert of the real. Baudrillard covered the first Gulf War from his hotel room. The war was not waged on Saddam, the Vietnam syndrome. CNN won, so here we are on the fast track to world domination. Neoliberalism ain't nothing humanitarian but interventions. You only go with his natural resources. In Ivory Coast, French troops are killing for chocolate. Villages burn and UN fires over civilians. Meanwhile, we picking sides in civil war. But more died in Syria than Libya. That's the devil we know. So on,
yeah.
But let's offer burn, cause ain't nothing but straw huts and sand. It's a sham. Democratic war machine remarketed. And I ain't with it. Think about it. If Bush did it, we'd be protesting. We can't let the UN fast track it and be kingmakers. We gotta stay out the Middle East. Noam Chomsky. I think I'm Noam Chomsky. My peers are on some bullshit. I must be Noam Chomsky. Twitter feed look like I'm ready for war. Vonnegut is dead. Do me a favor, don't comment on my Facebook if you disagree. Showing pictures of your abdomen and Kardashian strippers. I'll take you on a Gaza strip tour where you can get killed for being the wrong religion in the wrong region. So let's get real, for every Israeli citizen that dies. Airstrikes kill four people living in Palestine. Women and children dying in the largest prison known to man. You can't call me anti-Semitic, I pay for those guns. And my Jewish friends who read the news must be anti-Semitic too. Besides, Arabs are considered Semitic people as well. So the Israeli Defense Forces and Apache helicopters must be the biggest anti-Semites in the world. We manufacture the consent, the energy companies manufacture the bombs. Indirectly, Time Warner sold chemical weapons to Saddam, but that's old news. Like Gulf of Tompkins started Vietnam, and the project for a new American century needed 911. Unwanted all over the world, like U.S. bases. They call me everywhere, but never in America. I'm Noam Chomsky, apologist for war crimes. Same abuse of communists. You show your ignorance of an anarchist, like Noam Chomsky, Vietnam vet, and they killed me in the jungle. Post-traumatic stress ain't covered. So whether you come home in the box or a straight jacket, America don't love you, economy's in the pits. Act like you have a choice, rap like you got a voice. Fight back, ain't no one gonna say save us. Cause when Chomsky dies, we're more alone in the wilderness, surrounded by wolves, limping towards our own irrelevance. I wrote this song in 20 minutes, it's easy. Bitch, I'm Noam Chomsky. Noam Chomsky, I must be Noam Chomsky. Dropped out of college, started reading Noam Chomsky. My style is Amy Goodman, your Catholic Glenn Beck to me. Howardson is dead, I must be Noam Chomsky.
Hello, wage slaves. This is the Authority Smashing Hour. This is Zeno. I'm joined by Chomsky.
Hey, what's up, Derek? How's it going?
Hey, doing pretty good. Doing a lot of organizing here locally where I am in Florida. Trying to put together a people's library. Hopefully get out more of the word of Chomsky.
Sounds good. We're really busy up here in Boston. It's just getting cold again in late December. But, yeah, I've been busy. That's why we've been away for so long. How do you feel coming back?
I feel pretty good. I really hate being away, and I'm kind of working it MacGyver style here without the computer at full strength. How are you doing over there? It sounds pretty busy over at E5.
Oh, yeah. Over here at E5, the Occupy Boston movement has shifted their focus and doing a lot of workshops, meetings out of this space. And it's been great. It's been really hopping here. You could hear in the background people mic checking.
Awesome.
But, yeah, I think... it's been busy. Everything's going. Where it's headed, who knows? But it's exciting to be part of it. So just to introduce a little bit, this is our the Authority Smashing Hour. It's a show that we've been doing for the last couple of years, and we had to take some time off because of our organizing efforts, but. Maybe you could give our new listeners from Occupy Boston Radio a little bit of an introduction.
Yeah, this is our anarchist radio show on the internet, bringing you radical analysis of news, and we analyze the news, politics, and we give commentary from people maybe not necessarily heard, like Paul Street and Noam Chomsky. And we try to get as many reports from the front lines that we can, like taking part in the Occupy movement and other protests. And we are members of the Industrial Workers of the World.
That wasn't always true, but now I think now we're 100% IWW, which is impressive. But, yeah, we're not professional media people. We're just doing this, trying to give ourselves a voice. In the landscape. And Blog Talk Radio, I mean, it's filled with right-wing junk, and we kind of stand apart from that. So, you know, we try what we can. So why don't we go ahead and get into the headlines?
All right. Let's see, the first one, I know this is a lot of people are keeping an eye on this. The alleged U.S. Army whistleblower, Private Bradley Manning, made his first court appearance Friday after being held for more than a year and a half by the U.S. military. As everybody knows, the 23-year-old Manning is suspected of leaking hundreds of thousands of secret U.S. diplomatic cables to the whistleblowing website WikiLeaks, and the biggest leak of classified U.S. documents in history. And this pretrial hearing was held at Fort Meade in Maryland, and the Bradley Manning Support Network organized a protest outside the gates of Fort Meade in solidarity with the accused soldier. Manning's court appearance coincided with the completion of the U.S. military withdrawal from Iraq after an 8-year occupation, and Manning could get life or even the death sentence if they so chose it.
Yeah, I don't watch a lot of TV, at least a lot, not a lot of news, but I saw his appearance. It's just a kid. I mean, 23 years old. And it's got to be taxing on him, and he seemed kind of out of it. I don't know. I mean, I'm not a physician or a psychiatrist, whatever, but what he's going through is basically torture. I mean, being in the solitary confinement, you know, for, I think, doing what honest people would do, living up to his, you know, role as a responsible citizen. So it's an outrage.
And I'm not even sure if it's even proven that he was the actual leaker or if he was the leaker. There is no evidence that Julian Assange put him up to it. So it seems like he's being tortured into incriminating Assange so we can try to extradite and throw Julian Assange in Gitmo.
Right, right. But yeah, I mean, what's going to happen, nobody knows. We need to keep an eye on it, and we need to show our solidarity, even as radicals who might not even, I mean, for me personally, I don't think anything that was leaked was a real shocker. And I don't think it has had the effect that some people would make it out to be, like WikiLeaks, basically confirm what we already know from, you know, just institutional analysis. But I think this is where we have to show our solidarity. And, yeah, let's keep at it and see if we could have some form of justice here. Any other thing?
As to his mental state, I'd like to remind people that the accused dirty bomber, Jose Padilla, was held in similar military conditions for at least a couple years by the Bush administration. And he basically, from solitary confinement, he was reduced to a total mental breakdown. And in this we may be seeing signs of a similar mental deterioration of mind in Bradley Manning. So I think we should keep thinking about Bradley on there.
Yeah, we need to kind of expand the definition of torture a little bit here. But anyways, got any on the news?
Yeah, the Justice Department has issued a scathing report accusing Joe Arpaio of widespread discrimination and civil rights violations against Hispanics and unlawful retaliation against critics who spoke out in opposition. On Thursday, federal investigators said Sheriff Joe Arpaio of Maricopa County targeted Hispanic residents, illegally detaining and then denying them basic rights behind bars. The findings could subject Arpaio to court order reforms. He is also currently under criminal investigation by a criminal grand jury in Phoenix. On the heels of the report, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security has announced it's cutting its ties with Arpaio, including the suspension of programs under which undocumented immigrants are handed over to federal authorities for deportation. The report comes at a time Arpaio has recently faced growing calls to resign following mounting evidence of his police department neglecting scores of sex crimes. And in those cases, those are various sex crimes and sexual molestation of children that are being completely ignored because the victims are Hispanic.
Right, right. I mean, I guess it's a good step, but we have to be careful not to get into persecuting certain persons in the powerful positions. We have to keep in mind the institutional structure here. So the sheriff is basically enforcing certain legislation, certain policies that the state of Arizona and actually, you know, the federal government is, trying to enforce. So it's the system of racial oppression and all these things that are at work here, and this is just a symptom. So I think that sometimes protesters and, progressives, lefties, we get lost in the whole thing. in trying to condense certain persons where we should be talking about the system. So, it's like during the civil rights movement, you know, as long as they were condemning racist sheriffs in the South, it was acceptable to power, right? But when you start talking about structural changes like, economics, or if you're talking about our rights, our quote-unquote rights to invade other countries, you get condemned, as MLK, Martin Luther King, was later in his career. So we always have to keep that in mind.
Absolutely, and that's also that systemic institutional analysis is something that the Occupy movement should really keep in mind when it comes to the police and the relationship of police power to protest.
Right. I mean, the police is one part. I also think the whole 1% slogan, and it is what it is. It's catchy. I think it has served to mobilize a sector of the population. But we have to, kind of be careful about that. You know, what kind of institutional things that made the 1% what they are? Or it's not even the 1%. It's the top 10th of the 1% that owns, 50% of everything. What causes concentrations of wealth like that? And be able to, formulate policies. So those are the questions that we have to ask, and not just kind of, it's not a blame game to throw around, which the right wing attacks us for, and sometimes justifiably so. We always have to be careful with that.
Makes it out to be attacking the rich individuals as greedy, evil people.
Right. And, they might be nice people. They have nice family lives and whatever, but it's their role in the society that really matters. So, it's not a sexy thing to protest. It's really hard to protest against a whole abstraction, basically, for many people. But these things exist. These institutions exist, and very nice people. I'm sure Steve Jobs was a nice guy. Although some reports says he's kind of an asshole, but they do charity work, all this stuff. But that doesn't matter. It's about what role are they playing in the oppressive institution, I really can't hammer this enough. Like on this show, we've talked about it a million times. Do you want me to read the UN thing?
Absolutely.
Okay, so the UN urges global LGBT protections. The United Nations urging governments worldwide to enact new protections for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people and repeal discriminatory laws. In its first official report on the issue, the United Nations says LGBT people face rampant discrimination and violence in all regions of the world, including attacks with, quote, a high degree of cruelty, unquote. On gay marriage, the United Nations also urges governments to ensure that, quote, all unmarried same-sex couples are treated in the same way as entitled to the same benefits as unmarried opposite-sex couples. So what do you think about that?
Well, I think that's a damn good start, and of course the usual suspects of the United States with our evangelicals and everything, and probably certain actors in the Middle East, and repressive regimes like Saudi Arabia or something will probably be on the anti side of this and hold it up in the UN.
Right. Also, I think we kind of have to also be careful with this. It could be used as a justification for imperial pursuits, just like we've seen that in the justifications for all the wars in the Middle East. Afghanistan is supposed to liberate Afghani women. And that has some certain appeal to progressive liberals types, you know, placating on people's morality here. But in reality, it's very far from the truth. Just recently, we were reminded of that because Christopher Hitchens passed away, and he used that to his, you know, his efforts in justifying Afghanistan and Iraq. He used it over and over again. So, yeah, we kind of have to be careful. I mean, it's the same thing with the responsibility to protect.
Yeah.
You know, like, protect what? You know, like, if it fits your imperial vision, you'll want to protect it. But what about people in Palestine, right?
Yeah, Israel is really abusing LGBTQ politics with their pinkwashing campaigns to make it look like they are an oasis of progress and a utopia for gay people in the middle of the evil Muslim Middle East. And that, you know, we have to gay people should support Israel.
Right, right. So do you want to read the last one?
All right. I had a couple things here. I wanted to kind of poke fun at Time Magazine has chosen the protester for its annual 2001 Person of the Year. But I wanted to get into some facts and figures real quick. About poverty and in America, and basically there were some new figures that show hunger, poverty, and economic decline are increasing at record levels across the United States. The Census Bureau reports nearly half of Americans have either fallen below the poverty line or are classified under the category of low income. The number of low-income residents is at 97.3 million, coupled with 49.1 million in poverty, for a total of 146.4 million. The figure marks an increase of 4 million over 2009. Meanwhile, the U.S. Conference of Mayors reports all but four of 29 major cities saw an increase in requests for emergency food assistance between September 2010 and August 2011. And I also wanted to point out that that analysis of the census data is also showing that the wealth gap between younger and older Americans has rapidly increased, and the typical U.S. household headed by a person age 65 or older has a net worth of 47 times greater than a household headed by someone under 35. The wealth gap is now more than double what it was in 2005 and nearly five times the disparity a quarter century ago after adjusting for inflation. The median net worth for younger age households is now just $3,600, down from 68% from a quarter century ago. And on employment figures that I wanted to point out, that the nation's official unemployment rate fell slightly to 9% in October, but government figures show just 80,000 jobs were added in the month. According to economist Dean Baker, at the current pace, it will take more than 33 years to return to the pre-recession rates of unemployment. Meanwhile, unemployment checks have now run out for the majority of Americans out of work, and that shift points to a growing crisis of long-term unemployment. And of course, early last year, 75% of unemployed workers received unemployment checks. Now the figure is just 48%. And one bit of news I'm trying to ignore is the hubbub and bullshit partisan wrangling over continuing the unemployment checks. Do you have any thoughts on that, on these numbers too?
Yeah, I mean, it's very discouraging, depressing, but I don't think it's a surprising thing. I think it's been a trend for the past 30 years, and you can see it reflected in the policies that you know, preceded that. I think that also we have to make it clear that it's not that the U.S. is poor. Yes, large part of the population has fallen into poverty, but if you look at GDP numbers and whatever, you know, corporate profit rates, they're through the roof, you know. I think I saw a thing where just last year, the CEO pay was up by something crazy like 30-40%, just last year. And this is, you know, during one of the worst recessions, right? So, you know, yeah, we kind of have to be careful of crying poor, and that's what the right wing likes to do. And what it does is to make them make the population susceptible to rhetoric that enacts these cutbacks in social welfare systems.
Yeah, this country is not broke. This is just an unwillingness to pay for these programs.
Right. You know, like our friend Sean, he always talks about the largest military acquisitions in the history of the world. You know, we have billions of dollars to spend on F-35s. It's not a secret, you know. So we have almost a thousand military bases around the world. So these are facts that has to go together with these census reports. You have to make it clear to people that it's not that we're poor. It's because I mean, just the whole the food figure. I mean, that's crazy. Like, the food industry throws away billions of dollars in food. We're not lacking in food, you know. So, anyways, you just have to hammer that home. So we have a guest in the studio. Do you want to talk to her?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's fellow Wobbly Grania O'Neill. She works at Harvard as a Well, she could introduce herself. Let me put her. Hi, Grania.
Hi.
You can just talk into the phone.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, I'm talking into my phone. My name's Grania. I'm a Wobbly, and I work at the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice at Harvard Law School. It's a very long name of my institute, but I'm a staff attorney there. I was a public defender, and I guess I'm here with Turnchi today.
And also, you've been participating in the Occupy movement. Can you talk about a little bit about your participation?
Yeah, well, of course, when the Occupy movement started, it was very exciting to everyone. You know, a few weeks in, when we saw that they were holding this public space and having consensus-based general assemblies, and I was really glad when it started spreading to other cities and now to actual neighborhoods and cities where people were getting together where they lived to talk about issues related to where they were and meeting each other and really trying to sort out some problems. And I think that a lot of the things that people have criticized it for, you know, focusing on the camps and not you know, focusing on outside, like, political structures were actually the real benefits to the Occupy movement. People were living and figuring out how to share food and share resources and making decisions about their own lives in a way that we hadn't really seen happen in America in a long time. So I guess maybe ever, I don't know. But it was really exciting just to see people trying to learn from each other's experiences and learn about what each other cared about. And I at least personally witnessed a lot of growth. People would come in and, you know, have a lot of preconceived notions about whatever struggle they had been involved in, and they were really, through sharing space and through working together, they were learning about some of the problems that, you know, their fellow occupiers were facing every day. So it seems like a really good thing to me. And I'm involved in the Occupy Boston tech team. And we're kind of a different tech team than a lot of the other occupies. We have a strong commitment to free, Libre, open source software, and we brought it to the General Assembly, and the General Assembly agreed to get off Google Groups and stop using proprietary corporate-run software. And so at Occupy Boston, everything is run by this tech collective, May 1st People's Link, which is based out of New York. And, you know, it's a little bit harder to use than what everyone's familiar with, which is Google, I guess, at this point. But it's been working, and we're really proud and happy about that.
Yeah, we're using a corporate entity Block Talk Radio right now, but I think we're a little bit technophobes, so that's what happens.
Well,
but you have to bring us.
We will. I mean, Occupy Boston just created a radio station internally that's running 24/7. We're using all free and open source software, FLOSS, it's sometimes called in the business, but I guess not the business in the movement. And, you know, it's been challenging, but we're making it work. So it's been good. And we'll get you off Blog Talk Radio. Don't worry.
Great, great. So I like what you said about people learning and growing together and through sharing. And I think as anarchists, we call that prefigurative politics.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think
is the next,
step for this movement now that we've been evicted?
I mean, I guess all of the occupies have been evicted, sort of. Not all of them. There are a lot of strong occupations in different cities. I read recently that in Boise, Idaho, the craziest place, Idaho, is about the last place you'd expect, but their newspaper has just come out strongly in favor of the occupation. And so there are a lot of occupations that are still occupying. But I guess I don't really know. I'm just really hoping that that spirit isn't morphed into some kind of demand for electoral political change. And that's, I'm very strongly in the camp of not making demands of power, but recreating our own society. And I don't want to see us get into this, like, you know, fight over whether we think that taxes should be raised marginally on rich people and things like that, or whether there should be a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. I don't think that that's productive at all. So I really am more interested in kind of trying to keep building this movement and building people's democracy, I guess. I mean, that's what it keeps being called, is a democratic movement, and that this is democracy. And I think as anarchists, we know that it's really anarchism, but I think it's fine to call it democracy all of the time too, because I guess it is horizontal democracy. And so I'm hoping that that stays and that we keep growing that power. And it's just really funny. As we've all seen, you know, we've all been using Twinkling for years, decades in our movement and in our work, and all of a sudden it's now mainstream and everyone's talking about consensus. It was on the Academy Awards. I saw someone tweeted or something that the Academy Awards had to come to consensus about their nominees or something. And I don't think that they would have said come to consensus. I would think they would have said voted. So I think it's made a dramatic shift in the idea of consensus and participation. And I guess I don't know what's next. I mean, are we going to squat a building? Are we going to, I don't really know. I mean, I guess I think that it's important to have space and it's important to have that community, because I think that that's what's really been keeping people in the U.S. down, is that we're not talking to each other and we're sort of learning about our neighbors from Fox News. So I do think that space is very important. I don't know how feasible it is anymore. If you go to our public parks now, they're all lined with police barricades, which is weird. I know in New York they've filed suit about the lack of access to Zuccotti Park or Liberty Square or whatever it's called. But because before, their argument was that it wasn't accessible to the public when the occupation was there, but now it's actually totally not accessible to anybody. So I don't know where we're going to go with that or what we're going to do, but I hope that it's open out there somewhere, somehow.
Well, what did you think about the port shutdowns?
I mean, it seemed good. I don't know. It seemed like they didn't – I don't really know about what happened specifically with – it seemed like some of the port workers were upset about it. But I think in general, I think it's good for people to show the power that we all have. And I'm glad that they did that, and I wish that it had been more successful, I guess, the second time around, or that we on the East Coast would have gotten a little bit more involved.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for calling in.
Hey,
and joining in. Unless, you have any other questions, Turnchy?
She's going to stay with us for a little bit. Let's just go straight to Cindy Milstein, speaking on, was it on KPFK?
Yes.
Okay. She's just speaking on Occupy.
Okay, so we're gonna move on to a discussion with Cindy Milstein. Cindy Milstein is a board member of the Institute for Anarchist Studies, co-organizer of the Renewing the Anarchist Tradition Conference, and author of Anarchism and its Aspirations from AK Press, that's 2010, and the forthcoming collaboration with Eric Ruin, Paths Towards Utopia, Explorations in Everyday Anarchism, that's PM Press in the spring of 2012. She has been overly engaged in numerous collective projects aimed at creating autonomous spaces of resistance, reconstruction, and education, including most recently Station 40 in San Francisco and before that Black Sheep Books in Montpelier, Vermont. She also taught at the quote-unquote anarchist summer school called the Institute for Social Ecology and has long been involved in community organizing social political movements from below. Cindy, welcome to Indie Media on Air.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you, and I know that you've been heavily involved in the Philadelphia occupation. Maybe you could tell our listeners what's going on in Philadelphia, because it seems as though that crackdown was imminent there last night, just like it was in Los Angeles, but that did not happen.
Yeah, we were all really conscious of standing in solidarity with L.A. last night. A lot of people talked about that while we were waiting for the eviction to happen. I feel like with both LA, but also particularly in Philly, we started the occupation October 6th, and the city and the police, the mayor, have been using this strategy of trying to pretend that they're nice and worried about social and economic justice and want to work with us, and that actually it's been intriguing, you know, to try to both people that are kind of believe in those institutions within the occupation movement, it's been really hard to get them to understand that that's a tactic. And now they've kind of reused that with the eviction too. So, you know, we had a 5 p.m., you know, you must move by 5 p.m. Notice last night. And again, you know, just like in L.A., thousands of people showed up. It was really, a really energizing night last night. Just so many people came that have not been able to spend a lot of time there or that wanted to show support or that were newly excited about it. And it just felt like a whole new kind of level of, you know, movement building and bringing people there, and stayed strong all night. A lot of messaging, really, you know, really just lively, wonderful General Assembly and speak out and singing and food all night and spontaneous marches and dances and all sorts of things. And, you know, no police. So, you know, it kind of is continuing today the same way. So,
well, as we know, the system is clearly cracking down on this movement and trying its best to eradicate any of its existence from public spaces. And what I'd really like to talk to you about tonight is the tradition of anarchism in the political context of what's going on with Occupy Wall Street. And from a lot of your work, you've articulated very well the role that the politics of anarchism has played, and maybe we could just start with your assessment of that kind of politic in the context of Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I've mostly, like I said, been involved in. I moved to Philly just before this started, so I've been really engaged in Philly here, pretty much nonstop. But also, you know, the sort of wave of occupations across the continent and globally. I think are in huge ways beholden to the last 20 years, sort of since the Zapatista uprising in 1994, really beholden to a wave of global movements that were calling for, you know, redistributing power to create power from below, self-governance and self-organization and autonomy. And anarchists have been a big part of that in the last 20 years and longer, too, same with other people. But sort of one key pillar of all these movements that have largely been articulating the same type of politics. Anarchism has been really strong in that, and particularly starting very visibly in North America around the time of, you know, Seattle and a lot of the what people had called the anti-globalization movement, but was largely driven by an anti-capitalism that was very non-hierarchically organized. And most of the people involved in that, whether people visibly recognize that or not, were anarchists. The stereotype of anarchists has become the black block, mm. You know, young, you know, what people use the word militant, you know, at demonstration, anarchist. And what's been interesting, I think what people don't get is anarchists are everywhere. Anarchism is a way of structure, thinking about how you'd want to structure a society in a different way than we structure society right now. So I keep using this at Occupy Philly, but, you know, right now we pretty much live under a society structured around liberalism or neoliberalism, and it doesn't mean that all of us are liberals. And so anarchism isn't actually asking that everybody be an anarchist, but is saying, what would it look like to organize a world where everybody has an equal ability to figure out solutions to the problems that affect them, deliberate about it, and come to decisions about it, and then also implement and make that world happen and do it themselves together. And so what's been really amazing about the Occupy sort of upsurge, and I think which has sort of been to some degree hidden, is that a lot of the occupations around the country, there's a huge amount of anarchists that have been really integral to forms of self-organization. Because, not because, you know, we're rushing in because we want everybody to be an anarchist, but because I sort of feel like we're, to some degree, really good technicians of how to do this, because this is kind of what we live for, what we practice all the time in all our projects. So here in Philly, for instance, there's a really, really long tradition of anarchism in Philly. There's just, you know, long, the Wooden Shoe is a anarchist anti-authoritarian bookstore that's about to celebrate its 35th year here in Philadelphia this coming weekend, just one of many institutions. So it almost was just inevitable that the many, many, many anarchists in Philly, for instance, were just super excited to see a movement spring up that was all about self-organization and mutual aid and cooperation and self-governance. We, you know, anarchism really advocates when we want to make decisions, we'll do it through forms of direct democracy, and where everybody gets to participate equally and everyone gets to decide what they want to do. And so that's what's really, I think, again, been kind of intriguing about this movement is anarchists, in a sense, have provided a lot of the values and the structure and some of the techniques, how to facilitate, how to, you know, run a meeting, how to organize food. But we're not the only people there, which is why, actually, I think it's much more remarkable. And that's, for me, it's been... It's really like, how would we run a society together where people aren't the same and we have all sorts of different things we care about and we're upset about and we're dreaming about, and how do we make that work in which everyone gets a voice and gets heard and gets to contribute? And that's a real dilemma then for people that are anarchists, because by and large, I think on the flip side of it is a lot of anarchists engage in projects that are very comfortable for anarchists because we engage with other anarchists in, you know, setting up projects like a bookstore that's an anarchist bookstore that we do together, or we do with people at least that are excited about doing it non-hierarchically. And here we are with part of a giant movement with all sorts of people, some of whom are very trusting of police or other forms of, you know, top-down power, or have very different viewpoints and very different ideas and very different experience levels. But that's the real work of what it, to me, means to forge a society that's based on some of the principles I believe in.
And that leads me to my question about process. I mean, for many people who have been involved in collective type of organizations, one of the key issues is about how you make decisions. And oftentimes when I do consensus trainings, I always refer to this idea that we grow up in a very top-down society, very authoritarian. We're either taught to give orders or taught to take them, often taught to take them. And to learn to be in a process, it's equivalent to being rained on, and then you come into a dry place, and you're going to be wet for a long time, unlearning behavior that we've been taught our entire lives. And so process is very much a part of this movement. And as we know from so much has been written, as I'm sure you're aware, of what this Occupy movement is, and we've heard a lot about the original organizers from New York, who had a lot of anarchist influence, and of course the General Assembly coming from the, you know, as you said, the quote unquote anti-corporate globalization movement. So there's experience there, and it seems it sort of set a tone. But can you speak to the issues of process and what that means as a part of this movement?
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that's really the heart of it. It's like so many less that it's, I get the framing around 99% how powerful it is to bring everybody. It opens up a space for people to get involved that never think of themselves as political, and that's been really phenomenal and difficult because there's a whole bunch of people coming into what they understand to be politics with, as you said, very socialized around what they think politics is, which is, but at the same time, there's kind of this gut level feeling that all the ways, all these systems that are around us, capitalism or, you know, states, that they're have completely and utterly failed people. And what I think has been really powerful about the Occupy movement is people have come to these very public places out of the sense that there's some sense of suffering they feel or alienation or wrong that they hardly can articulate, and suddenly they look around and there's everybody articulating everything that's bothering them. And it's this really profound moment of finding each other and realizing, and I think this is really profound in the United States, particularly more than anywhere in the world, where we're taught that we as individuals, if we just pull ourselves up, we can make it. And if we don't make it, we're lazy or we're stupid or we're the problem. A very individualistic way of understanding. But everybody right now is increasingly being hurt by systems that are actually collectively hurting us. So I think there's this moment where there's a huge shift in the United States where people are seeing themselves as a collectivity and in a shared suffering in that collectivity, but also shared possibility to create something new. And that, to me, is the heart of it. A lot of people keep saying, oh, it's a protest movement, or, you know, it wants specific, you know, different individual little things to change. But I actually think, and people have written about this, but I still think this keeps getting overlooked, is it is actually the process of us trying to build the world right now and grapple with how hard that is together. But that's what's beautiful about it, is we're not actually spending so much time protesting, we're spending time practicing what it would look like to provide health care or to provide food. Or last night at Occupy Philly, people did really incredible, like, it was mostly spray painted and it was on big boards on how many meals we'd provided every day, for instance, to each other. And it was like 1,500 meals a day and something like almost, I don't even know where they got the dollar figure, because some of it was just total human caring, but the medics had said we've provided $300,000 of almost of, you know, free medical care. And for most people in Philly, we don't have health insurance, much less health care. So, you know, there's this phenomenal way in which people are trying this very, like, non-hierarchical way to provide that for each other. But we're really, really bad at it. So the heart of this movement, I think the beauty is this cry for direct democracy, for taking the world back together and making it so it's humane and caring for each other. But I think the hard part about it is, for me, this is what I've lived for, dreamed about, is a moment we can actually practice together on a really widespread level what it means to self-govern. And I also realize how completely and utterly difficult it is, both within the structures we live under and the way we're socialized, but also just how we're just
Did it cut off?
Yeah, I think it did. What happened, man?
I don't know. Again, using Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, this evil corporate thing. So why don't we play a song by Ryan Harvey, and then we'll come back and do Radical History and end the show.
All right.
All right.
Like, was it worth it? Where were we? Some were watching it all on headline news. The shock and awe, the night vision flash, the Baghdad sky, the bright green glare. We were hypnotized and we fell asleep, or our brains were clogged, because now we're stomping through Iraq like a big dumb dog. That's us, richest country on the earth, fulfilling its role as a murderer. And it's dangerous to act like this, because when the cycle repeats, it comes back to us. Was it worth it? Was it worth it? Was it worth it? The torture trial, they caught him red-handed. They're still in denial. Was it worth it? Remember that? The Patriot Act passed. Everybody blinked. It happened that fast. No one read it. They'd assign their names, and now they're filling up the cells of Guantanamo Bay. And there's a lot of bullshit, security cameras, terror-level color scheme, fear propaganda, stories on the news of a perpetual plan, a sleeper cell from Afghanistan. Was it worth it? Was it worth it? Was it worth it? The facts denied, the daily car bomb suicide. Was it worth it? Burning homes, the bursting steel, the hyped up stories, the backroom deals. Everybody's against it who's been paying attention, except a few still trapped in that sick dimension where it's profit first, kill or be killed, kill or be less rich, or just kill for a power trip. Call it peace, they'll love it. Was it worth it? Was it worth it? Was it worth it? The contract bids, the pictures of the kids with the missing limbs. Was it worth it?
We're back on the Authority Smashing Hour. Was that worth your 4 minutes, Derek?
All right, we got Radical History.
You missed
for today, December 12th, or does mean God, 12/18/2011. Can you hear me all right on that end?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, I was just making sure. I tried to play a little theme bump, but I guess it didn't play. all right, on this date in 1865 in the U.S., chattel slavery is abolished. Ratification of the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, ensuring that neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist within the United States.
Yeah, but wage slavery still exists. And actually, for like hundreds... 100 years after the abolition, you know, black people in the South and the North still lived in horrible conditions. So.
And under debt peonage, people were just rounded up by the police.
Yeah.
And using the prison system, were put to work as slave labor for major corporations.
Yeah, so they basically reconstituted the system. Anyways, in 1946, on this day, Black rights activist Steve Biko was born, South African Azanian, leader of the Black Consciousness Movement, murdered by the South African police in 1977.
That's a pretty sad shame there. And in 1969, Great Britain abolishes capital punishment, one of the last countries in Western Europe to do so. They're still waiting on us.
Yeah. In 1972 today, despite Kissinger's October 26th statement that peace was at hand, the U.S. Launches the heaviest air barrage of the entire Indochina War against North Vietnam. The so-called Christmas bombing included in the target was Bac Mai Hospital. Here's a quote by Dick Nixon in May of 1966. A quote, a retreat by the United States from Vietnam would be a communist victory, a victory of massive proportions, and would lead to World War III. So that was the fanaticism in which they prosecuted the war. Okay,
all right, in
2001,
federal judge refuses Mumia Abu-Jamal's request for a new trial, upholding his 1982 conviction of first-degree murder charges. The judge does throw out Abu-Jamal's death sentence, a decision only recently upheld. And I want to remind everybody that he was indeed spared the death penalty after prosecutors dropped their 30-year bid for execution.
Right. So let's wrap up the show. So what did you learn today, Derek?
Well, I learned that some reform can be had within the system, but it's fleeting and momentary, and that revolution is ultimately our end path.
All right. So with that said, thank you, Derek, and thanks to Grania, fellow workers. And we'll be back, and we'll try to do better next time. Take care.
9 to 5 in a job that we hate, more than our minds to serve food.